Good evening and welcome to tonight's event. My name is Justin Wojak and I am the president of Princeton Faith in Action. On behalf of all those in attendance tonight, I would like to sincerely thank Professor Singer and Mr. D'Souza for their being here with us and for their enthusiasm about tonight's topic. I would also like to thank those who helped plan this event and for our sponsors, Christian Union and the Fixed Point Foundation, who have made this event possible. It is our hope that tonight's event stimulates engaging and thoughtful conversation about this important subject across our campus. Now let me introduce our moderator this evening, our very own Professor Eric Gregory of the Religion Department at Princeton. Having been educated at Harvard, Oxford, and Yale, Professor Gregory finally made it to Princeton in 2001. In 2007, he was awarded the Princeton's President's Award for Distinguished Teaching. I myself am fortunate to have a class with him this semester, and we are fortunate to have him as our moderator this evening.
Friends, let me add my welcome to you and my thanks to Justin and our sponsors for tonight's exciting debate between Peter Singer and Dinesh D'Souza. It perhaps may be the most exciting debate of a fall full of debates. And my task as moderator is to keep us on time. So let me invite you, as they say at the movies, a second time to please turn off your cell phones and perhaps at this point gently remind you of the best of Princeton's traditions of public dialogue, spirited inquiry, and mutual respect. Our topic is, can there be morality without God? A question that admits many possible senses, and we leave it to our speakers to define the terms in their response. The format is as follows. Each speaker will be given a 15-minute opening statement, followed by 5 minutes of rebuttal and 5 minutes of cross-examination for each speaker. We will then open the floor to questions, which will be solicited on note cards found in the program and collected after the opening statements. Each speaker will have 3 minutes for a closing statement, and we will wrap things up about 10:15 with the question resolved, or perhaps better questions raised, and just in time for the students to go back to the library. Our distinguished speakers are prolific, provocative, and influential. They are widely acclaimed both inside and outside the academy. Peter Singer is the Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics at the University Center for Human Values here at Princeton University, a position he has held since 1999. He was educated at the University of Melbourne and the University of Oxford. Professor Singer was the founding president of the International Association of Bioethics and founding co-editor of the journal Bioethics. He first became internationally known after the publication of Animal Liberation in 1975. His many other books include Practical Ethics, How Are We to Live?, Rethinking Life and Death, One World, The President of Good and Evil, and The Way We Eat, Why Our Food Choices Matter. His newest book, The Life You Can Save, Acting Now to End World Poverty, will be published in March. Dinesh D'Souza is a former scholar at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Before joining the Hoover Institution, Mr. D'Souza was the John M. Olin Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. In 1987, he served as senior policy analyst at the Reagan White House. He graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Dartmouth College in 1983. And Mr. D'Souza's many books include the New York Times bestsellers What's So Great About America, and his 1991 book, Illiberal Education. His latest book is titled, What's So Great About Christianity? We begin with Professor Singer.
Thank you very much, Eric, for that introduction. I'd like to thank Princeton Faith in Action, Christian Union and Fixed Point Foundation as well for making this event possible. I'm speaking here tonight because I think that it's important that universities should discuss the big issues, and certainly this is one of those big issues. Can there be morality without God? And I want to focus for a moment on that question, that we are discussing that particular question, whether there can be morality without God. We are not discussing any particular set of moral views held by any particular atheist, and that includes the views that I hold. I mention this, you might think I needn't be that specific, because there was a press release circulated by the Christian Union a few days ago which referred to an earlier debate that Dinesh D'Souza and I had had on a different topic, and then stated, "The Princeton debate promises to be even more heated as the topic is deliberately framed to focus attention on Singer's controversial views on ethics and morality." Well, I have to say that was news to me, and I think that if that's what you're here for, you might leave now. Because it's obvious that that wouldn't answer the question that we're talking about. In other words, you can't argue Peter Singer's morality is the morality of an atheist, Peter Singer's morality is indefensible, therefore the morality of atheists is indefensible in general. That would be just like arguing Osama bin Laden's morality is the morality of a theist, Osama bin Laden is a theist, therefore the morality of theists is indefensible. Neither is a valid argument. So I want to focus on the particular question that we are discussing without getting distracted by issues about whether views that I hold are or are not right. If Faith in Action or Christian Union want to come back and organise a debate some other time specifically about my views, I'll be happy to do that. That's not what we're doing tonight. What we are doing tonight is to discuss the issue that is often summed up in the contention famously put forward by Ivan Karamazov in Dostoevsky's The Karamazov Brothers, where he said, actually he didn't exactly say this, it isn't a quote, but it is a reasonable summary, if there is no God, everything is permitted. So I want to say, well, should we believe that? Why should we believe that? Why would anyone think, for example, consider any of the atrocities that we have sadly had to witness in this century, young as it still is? Think about 9/11, think about Darfur, or about the Congo, what's been happening there, or more recently, just very recently, fresh in our memories, what happened in Mumbai. And ask yourself, well, if there were no God, would all that be permitted? One question that you might occur to you then is, well, what do you mean? Permitted by whom? So, obviously, these actions, these atrocities, are not permitted by law in any nation, as far as I'm aware, these sorts of things. And even now internationally, we have a developing body of international law. We have an international criminal court which exists to make sure that even where these things, these crimes are not prosecuted in the country in which they're committed, that they are against international law and that people can be tried in the international criminal court, despite the best efforts of the professedly Christian administration of this country over the last 8 years to undermine the status of the International Criminal Court and to refuse to be part of it. So these things are not permitted by law, but of course we're not really talking about law, we're talking about morality. You might say, if you're a theist, that such acts are prohibited by God, and if there's no God, well, obviously they're permitted. Well, certainly it's true that if you're an atheist, you can't say they're prohibited by God. But first, the fact that some theists can say that some acts are prohibited by God doesn't make it true that they are. And if there is no God, then it's obviously also not true that they're prohibited by God. That statement is false. So I'm just going to take 1 minute of my time, perhaps, to say why I think they can't be prohibited by God, because there isn't a God in the sense of a God in the Judeo-Christian tradition. There are other gods about which perhaps I might have other doubts, but the God of the Judeo-Christian tradition is supposed to be a God who is omniscient, omnipotent, and omnibenevolent, all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good. And if you look at the world around us, indeed, if you look at some of the very events that I've been describing, I don't think there could be such a God in this world, because such a God would not permit these events to take place. Now, if you might say, well, these events that I've described occur through human free will, and for some reason that's a greater good than the evils that humans commit, that still doesn't resolve the problem, because there's also immense suffering that occurs without any intervention of human free will. For example, people die not only because they're killed by other humans, but they die in droughts, and they die in floods, and they die in earthquakes. And often these people are innocent of any conceivable sin, because perhaps they're a year old, and they die slow, lingering deaths. And it's hard to see how that can be justified or defended by free will. And even if, although I think this is a repellent doctrine, you were to say they suffer because they too have original sin, since they are descended from Adam and Eve, as indeed some Christians would say, we still have the insoluble problem of the suffering of non-human animals who are not descended from Adam and Eve, do not take part in original sin, and yet suffer slow, lingering deaths in droughts and famines and earthquakes, just as humans do. So I think there is no reconciliation of the existence of that kind of suffering and the kind of God of the Christian and Jewish traditions. So I think that it's not a good argument to say that these things are not permitted because God prohibits them, because you would need to defend the idea that such a God exists. So I think that the question, can there be morality without God, really comes to a question of, can there be morality, given that we are in a universe without God? But of course, we can suspend our disbelief in God and ask questions about what difference would it make to morality if there were a God. So let's again then ask, why would one think that these acts that I mentioned, that I'm sure we all think and I think are morally wrong, would not be morally wrong if there were a God? And I'm going to mention three claims that people might make in defense of this. So the first claim is that the very concepts I'm using, the expressions right or wrong, even good or bad, would be meaningless if there were no God. They only have meaning in a universe with God because what they really mean, good and something we're obliged to, mean right, that God wills them. And conversely, that something is wrong or bad, we ought not to do it, means that God wills that they not exist or that they not be done. So we have a meaning to the words through God's will and God's commands. This is a famous position, but also one that has been famously refuted right in the early stages of Western philosophy in Plato's Euthyphro, where essentially the argument was, so what about these things that I've talked about, say? Obviously Plato wasn't talking about those things, but what about these things? Are they only wrong because God says they are wrong? Or does God say does God condemn them? Does God command that we not do them because they are wrong? And I think that's very puzzling for the person who defends the view that there is no meaning to right or wrong without the existence of God. Because if you say that they're only wrong because God wills them or wills the good, this condemns the bad, then you're essentially saying that God could have willed the opposite. God could have willed that we drop bombs on villages consisting entirely of civilians. God could have willed that we hack off the limbs of children in order to carry out our civil war in the Congo or in Darfur. And that would have been the right thing to do if God had willed it. And you can't say God wouldn't have willed it because it would have been wrong, because on this conception there is no meaning to it being wrong except that God wills it. So that doesn't seem a very plausible position to take. We really have to take the view that these things would have been wrong, that God, if you like, if you believe in God, condemned them because they were wrong of their nature, of their intrinsic nature. But then you have to admit that there is a meaning to the concept, at least, of right and wrong, independent of God's command. God doesn't give that term meaning, it has meaning prior to him. So the first claim, I think, does not survive that argument. The second claim sometimes made is, we can't know what is right or wrong without God's revelation to guide us. So yes, the terms have meaning, but we would be lost. We would be at sea, not able to separate right from wrong. Well, if there were a God, and if he had revealed his will about what is right or wrong, in clear and indisputable language that we could all accept, then perhaps you could run this line. Then perhaps you could say, God did reveal to us what is right or wrong. But he did not do that. It's quite extraordinary how often religious people refer to some sacred text as if it were the source of all moral knowledge, and then ignore half, the inconvenient half, of course, of what it actually says. And we have plenty of examples of that in the Christian world today, including in this country. Well, we're living in a society in which most people, anyway, say that they are Christian. And yet, they ignore the repeated insistence of Jesus in the Gospels that everyone, and especially the rich, should give to the poor. You remember that bit of it? You remember when he told the rich man, sell all your possessions and give them to the poor? In case you didn't get the message, he went on to say, it's as hard for a rich man to go to heaven as a camel to go through the eye of a needle. That sounds like it's not a good policy to remain rich if you want to go to heaven, doesn't it? Yet there's lots of rich Christians still in this country. That's a bit of the gospel that they don't really seem to want to follow. And there's lots of other injunctions, for example, many of them in the same course. He urged those who give feasts to invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, and the blind. Most of you probably had a feast last Thursday. Hands up, those who invited the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind. Don't see a lot of hands. I see one or two hands. Very good. Congratulations. That's excellent. That's nice to see. But there's about 800 people in this room, and I saw a dozen or so hands, maybe. So I think that we are not actually getting our guidance. People, Christians generally, do not follow. They choose selectively which bits of the Bible they want to follow. Consider what Jesus is reported to have said about divorce. Divorce, he said, either is just wrong altogether, depending which bit of the Gospels you read, or it's only permitted on the grounds of adultery. There's not many Christians, there are some, but there's not many Christians who adhere to that. Even fewer adhere to the idea that to marry a divorced woman is itself to commit adultery. Don't know a lot of Christians who've refused to marry a divorced woman. Not a divorced man, apparently, by the way. Not too sure exactly what the basis of that distinction is. On the other hand, Christians in this country seem to think that they have a lot of guidance from God in Christianity about views about abortion, about the use of obtaining stem cells from embryos, about homosexuality. There's no clear guidance in the Gospels anyway, in the New Testament, about that. People may say, well, it's not just the New Testament, we go to the Old Testament as well. But once you go to the Old Testament, you find a lot of amazing things that God is supposed to have said and commanded, and your job of working out which ones you want to follow is more difficult than ever. For example, God explicitly advocates genocide in the Old Testament. Not passages probably very often read in church, but look at Numbers 31, where God commands the Israelites to wreak his vengeance on the Midianites. And when they go there and destroy their villages and kill their cattle and slaughter the men, they bring back to Moses the women and the children. And Moses is angry. Moses said, "Why have you spared the women and the children? Go and kill them. Go and kill all the women who have known men by lying with them. And kill all the boys. But the girls who haven't known men, keep them for yourselves." Is that where you want to take your moral guidance from? I don't think so. So the scriptures that we have are not guidance to moral thinking. If we want to use them, we have to use our own judgment. We have to sort out for ourselves what's right and wrong. And that's what we're doing anyway, whether we take the scriptures as a sacred text or just take them as an interesting work of literature to discuss and think about. 2 minutes? Thank you. Okay. So let me move to the third claim. The third claim is that even though the terms right and wrong make sense, and even though we can find out what is right and wrong, nevertheless, people won't do it. This is perhaps what Ivan actually had in mind in the Karamazov brothers, because one thing he actually does say, this is a quote, "If there is no immortality, there is no virtue." Now, I admit it would be nice to believe that all the virtuous are going to be rewarded in an afterlife and all the wicked are going to be punished in an afterlife. And it would be even better, of course, if people believed that and acted in their long-term self-interest so that they didn't do things that they believed to be wrong because of this concern about punishment. But it actually doesn't seem to work. It's quite an interesting sociological fact. Of course, I think it's difficult to believe in the first place for reasons that I've spelled out. But it doesn't really seem to work. That is, when we compare more Christian countries with less Christian countries, like this one, for example, with European countries that have a lower level of religious belief and observance, we find that many of the things that Christians condemn, are actually more common here. Murder is more common in this country. We have a higher prison rate. And incidentally, some statistics I saw, a little bit dated, suggested that the number of atheists in prison was less than 1%, whereas of the prison population, whereas in the population as a whole, it's regarded as being perhaps 5, 8, 10%, considerably disproportionately small number of atheists in prison. Maybe they're just clever and don't get caught, of course. Let's go on. Abortion rates, teenage pregnancy rates, they're also higher in this country. Juvenile, we also don't look after despite the injunction I talked about, we don't look after the poor as well in this country as we do in Europe. We have higher rates of poverty, and we have less social support for those who are in poverty. And then, of course, we have the mystery of the various religious people, both evangelicals and Catholic priests, who are constantly talking about sin, constantly emphasizing sexual sins in particular, and are constantly committing them. Well, it's puzzling, isn't it, that if they believe in punishment in the afterlife, this doesn't seem to help them to control their urges, which we all have and which are sometimes difficult to control. But it doesn't seem to be successful in helping them to urge it. So I would say that none of these grounds, just sort of one more point, none of these grounds really would help us to believe in a morality without God. So I'm sure Dinesh is going to say that I've said a lot of negative things, but I haven't said anything about what ethics is. So I think since I'm out of time now, but I do have some time coming up after Dinesh has spoken, I'm going to say, hold on, you will get the answer to that question after we've heard from Dinesh.
Dinesh D'Souza.
I want to say how pleased and delighted I am to be here. I didn't go to Princeton. I went to Dartmouth, and I must say I was a little bit of a rebel when I was a student there. I edited a conservative campus newspaper that was a kind of thorn in the side of the Dartmouth administration, and we used to tell the deans that taking on our rebel paper was a bit like wrestling with a pig. Not only did it get everyone dirty, but the pig liked it. And it is in that spirit that I come here to tussle with Peter Singer, you might say, on his home turf, Princeton University. It falls to me to have the task, since Peter Singer, I think for understandable reasons, does not want to discuss his views. And so it is going to be, I guess, my task to discuss them. but not in the mode of arguing that this is proof that atheism doesn't work. Rather, I want to discuss Peter Singer's work as the effort of a very rare and gifted man attempting to develop, you might say, a truly secular morality, working out the consequences of what could be called true secularism. Now, why is this important? This is important because many of us think we live in secular culture. Hey, Princeton University is a secular campus. But right away, in this building itself, we have some clues that that's not entirely true. Princeton wasn't founded as a secular institution. It has ideas and institutional frameworks and codes that are very much derivative of its Christian origins. And in some senses, you may say it is subsisting on capital derived from its own unique theological and intellectual and educational history. We say Europe is secular, but if you walk around Europe, you find yourself drenched in Christian institutions, Christian monuments, Christian cathedrals, Christian symbols, and arguably the culture of Europe, even the culture that secularists and atheists champion, is in fact powerfully shaped by Christian assumptions, sometimes hidden Christian assumptions. So what I would like to do, if I may, is I want to begin with just a quote or two from Peter Singer, because I want to then expound a little bit later on the meaning of these quotes. He says, for example, that if we compare a severely defective human infant with a non-human animal, a dog or a pig, for example, we will often find the non-human to have superior capacities, both actual and potential, for rationality, self-consciousness, communication, and so on. What he's really getting at here is that we give to infants and sick people, particularly the mentally handicapped, rights. And his point is, why do we? We don't give the same rights to, well, he says right here, he says, we don't give the same rights to pigs and chickens. He says the calf, the pig, and the much-derided chicken come out ahead of the newly born infant in terms of sentience, comprehension, perhaps anticipating the future. Now, frankly, I find all of this a little disturbing, in part because I had chicken for lunch. And when I read this, it made me feel a bit like a cannibal. But what Peter Singer's getting at here is, in a sense, rights do not accrue because we are human. And for this reason, he says, and I want to quote him so I'm not getting him wrong. He says, in our book, Should the Baby Live?, my colleague Helga Kusi and I suggested that a period of 28 days after birth might be allowed before an infant is accepted as having the same right to life as others. The point he's trying to get at is he's not discussing abortion. He's saying that an infant, perfectly healthy, in essentially the first month after birth, has no rights and can be killed for any reason, or any good reason, perhaps. Now, in some senses, when I say this to people, they sometimes say, Peter Singer, he's a provocateur. He's just saying things to get people going and so on. I want to argue that this actually is unfair to Peter Singer and what he is trying to do. In some ways, what he's trying to do is very different than a lot of other... I've been debating several other of the so-called new atheists. Christopher Hitchens, the biologist, Richard Dawkins, and so on. And to a man, what those guys say is something like this. Sure, we can be moral without God. You don't need God to have morality. Because if Christians can do good stuff, be honest, kind, just, do charity, atheists can too. If there's a big famine in Rwanda tomorrow, the Christian can shed a tear, volunteer his or her time, write a check. But the new atheists say, well, we can do that too. God is superfluous. You don't have to believe in God in order to be moral. Now, on the surface, this, I think, is correct. I would not argue for a moment that Christians have any kind of monopoly on virtue or that atheists are not capable of it. But I think what it misses is it misses a deeper point. And that is that even if you make a list of all the values that secular people or atheists cherish, if you read the books of the new atheists, they say, we believe in the idea of the individual. We believe in the autonomy of science. We believe in the equal dignity of women. We believe in the worth of human life. We believe in compassion as a social virtue. And my point is, okay, but these values came into the West, and in some cases into the world, because of Christianity. How do we know this? It's pretty simple. First of all, we look at other cultures. Peter Singer mentioned a great famine. If there was a great famine in Rwanda tomorrow, you'd notice something rather interesting. All the Western countries would immediately rally, Doctors Without Borders, the Red Cross, missionaries, and so on. And in other cultures, China, India, there would be a kind of great silence. Why? When I grew up in India, we learned a proverb that says, in effect, that tears of strangers are only water. The basic idea here is you look after people when they are your people. But if someone is nothing to you, you wish them well, but you have no obligation to them. This idea of universal brotherhood is, in effect, a Christian idea. Consider the idea of the value of human life. You wouldn't find that value very powerfully present in ancient Greece or Rome before Christianity. The Spartans, we all know, would take the sick or defective child and stick it on the hillside and be perfectly happy to find it dead in the morning. Peter Singer cites such facts to, in a sense, recommend them, to say, hey, look what the ancient Greeks and Romans did, what the Bushmen of the Kalahari do. We should reconsider. We should bring back into our civilization. Consider the idea of compassion. Aristotle makes a list of the virtues. Compassion never appears on that list. In fact, elsewhere in Aristotle, compassion is treated more as a vice. So how did compassion become, if you will, the central political virtue of Western civilization? It became that because of Christianity. Well, consider the idea of equal rights, which I take it pretty much everyone in this room believes in, the equal dignity of women, the abolition of slavery. The fact is, slavery is a universal institution. We find it in China, in India, in ancient Greece and Rome, in Africa. There were slaves in the Americas long before Columbus got here. Anti-slavery, the movement to contest slavery, is uniquely Christian, and in some senses developed only in one civilization and not elsewhere. In fact, for many, many millennia, slavery needed no defenders because it had no critics. It was like the family, taken for granted. So how did slavery become controversial? Well, first of all, many people think that slavery was abolished only in the modern era. Not true. Slavery was mostly abolished in Europe between the 4th century and the 10th century. Replaced by serfdom, to be sure, which is not exactly a walk in the park. But at least it isn't being owned by some other guy. And then in the modern era, Christians began to take a theological proposition: we are created equal in the eyes of God. And derive from it a political corollary. Since we are created equal in the eyes of God, no man has the right to rule another man without his consent. And this idea becomes the basis not only of anti-slavery or abolition, it also becomes the basis of democracy. Because modern democracy, if you think about it, is based on the simple notion that no man, no person has the right to rule another without consent. So the point I'm trying to get at here is that much of what we call secular morality is itself standing, you might say, on a Christian pedestal. And all you have to do is probe it a little. Even Peter Singer's morality, I will show, has rooted in it Christian assumptions that he seems unwilling or reluctant to acknowledge. And I want to make a second point. Morality is a fact in the world. It's real. I'm not just talking, by the way, about the morality of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. When faced with the choice of two evils, always choose the one you haven't tried before. That's not the Ten. That's Mae West. Anyway, the point I'm making is we have all these moral codes. We have all these moral codes. And the question becomes, can these moral codes be understood better if you assume that there is a God or if you assume that there isn't a God? In other words, does morality require what can be called a transcendental foundation? Or can you explain morality, you might say, in purely secular terms? Let's consider the secular explanation, which is, in effect, we are evolved Darwinian primates. That's what we are, and that is all that we are. And I ask you, what sense does this make of morality? If we are evolved Darwinian primates, we are driven by an imperative to survive, to reproduce, to, you may say, acquire power, to consolidate our position in the world and in nature. And we do all those things. That's the Darwinian side of us. But I think everyone in this room knows that there is another side, not only to us, but in us, that not only seems inexplicable on the Darwinian account, but it seems to actively subvert and defy the Darwinian account. I'll give a simple example so everyone knows exactly what I mean. Let's say I'm walking on the riverbank, and I hear someone shout, "Help, help, help, I'm drowning." My initial instinct is to look over and see the guy flailing around in the water. I notice that he weighs 250 pounds. I notice also that I'm not a very good swimmer. And I feel this powerful Darwinian imperative to keep going. I ask myself, is this my brother? Is it a relative? Is someone I care about? No, it's a total stranger. I've never seen that guy in my life. Why on earth should I risk anything to help that guy? Keep going, Dinesh. But the moment I take steps forward to keep going, a little lamp lights on in my head and another voice, not mine, begins to speak against this and say, in effect, Dinesh, that's not right. You should try to help the guy. At least give him a stick and pull him to the shore. Of course, my Darwinian voice fires back and says, in effect, "No, what are you talking about? The guy weighs 250 pounds. Is it more likely you'll pull him out or he'll pull you in?" In other words, why take the chance? But if I keep going, if I listen, you may say, to my Darwinian instinct, I feel this powerful sense of qualms and anxiety and frustration. There is, in a sense, the unavoidable sense that I'm doing something wrong. It is almost as if it's not just a feeling, it's not just a reason, it is almost as if, you may say, there is a transcendental voice that is speaking within me that has no power to coerce me, but has every power, in a sense, to establish an ineradicable standard that even I, try as I may, cannot resist paying attention to. My question is, where does this transcendental, powerful sense that is within us, where does that come from? What is its Darwinian foundation? The bottom line is, I'm saying that whether or not we disagree on the margin about this morality or that morality, we all know that as human beings, we are moral creatures. And by moral creatures, what I mean is we have moral standards. Standards that we did not create. Now, we may not live up to those standards. Peter Singer's right about that. But that proves absolutely nothing. It simply means the standards are better than us. Quite frankly, if we devised them, most likely we would not devise standards that we could not live up to. The fact is, we embrace standards, you may say, that set a bar that none of us can fully jump over or scale. Now, in some senses, this idea that we are Darwinian primates can generate an attempt to create, you might say, secular morality. One reason I'm interested in Professor Singer's work is he says very clearly, he says, many of the things that we take for granted, for example, take the idea that human life is sacred. He says, that is not, if you will, morality, that's Christian morality. He says, man is on a Darwinian continuum with the beasts. We're not special. We're no different. He goes, but what Christianity has done, and what man has done more generally, is take Homo sapiens and put him on this pedestal and assign to him special protections and special rights, which are, as you may say, while demeaning the rest of creation. Sort of the biblical idea that the rest of creation is now man's to use for his instrumental purposes. And what Singer says is that once we realize that God is dead, we've got to reverse all this. We cannot do what the new atheists want to do. The new atheists want to kill God, but keep Christian values of liberty, equality, compassion, and so on. And Singer Singh can't do it. If you want to kill God, there goes human dignity. There goes the idea of the specialness of human beings. There goes the idea of human rights. Why he's working at an institute for human values, I have no idea. But nevertheless. Now, point I want to make is this. If we want to look at what secular morality really is, if we want to see if Dostoevsky is right, if God is not, everything is permitted, we cannot look to Belgium or France. We have to look really to the communist regimes of the 20th century. Efforts to really, you might say, purge Christianity, shut down the churches, kill all the priests, establish the new man and the new utopia, liberated from the shackles of traditional religion and traditional morality. And when you look at the body count of those atheist regimes, by the way, a body count that would make a bin Laden blush, even a junior league atheist like Pol Pot in Indochina managed to kill about 2 million people in the short space of 3 years. So atheism, you might say, not religion, is responsible for the mass murders of history. Peter Singer, when he advocates infanticide, when he advocates euthanasia, and when in the same breath he advocates animal rights, he puzzles some people, but he is really, in a sense, thinking through the implications of atheism. He's saying if you remove God, man comes down from the pedestal and the natural continuum with the animals is restored. I know that because Singer has advocated the killing of infants and so on, the killing of the handicapped, some people have said he's a Nazi. And he has protested this and said, this is ridiculous, I'm not a Nazi. And I think in a way he's right. Because the Nazis advocated, you might say, state-sponsored genocide. What Peter Singer advocates is actually something very different. Private sector homicide. In other words, don't make the government do it. You do it. Now, I cite Singer's work not to prove atheism or God, but to show you that secularism, when you really remove the religious presuppositions, is a little bit of a frightening idea. We might be moving in that direction, but if we do, the next time you have someone over for dinner, just make sure to count your spoons. Thank you very much.
We move on now to the rebuttals, starting with Peter Singer, who will have 5 minutes.
Thank you. Yes, we are Darwinian primates. We are, that is, primates who have evolved from other primates. I think that's established scientifically. Dinesh doesn't deny it, as I understand his position. Do we have to believe that there is some transcendental spark that is contrary to the evolutionary account in order to explain why we have morality and why we behave as we do, and why occasionally heroic people jump in and save heavy, drowning strangers, although also very often they don't? I don't think we do need any such account. I think we can explain the existence of compassion, concern for others, in the way we have evolved as mammals, as beings who've had to take care of their own children, as beings who've lived in small communities where we're often related to other members of the community and want to save them and support them, and that helps the survival of our genes as well. And of course, as social beings who live in communities that reciprocate, as indeed our close primate relatives do as well. We're not unique in this. And form reciprocal bonds. And there's a lot of research that suggests that the best strategy in these conditions is, at least initially, to help strangers. And only if it turns out that they are not going to help you do you then cease to help them or even pay them back for the bad deeds that they do you. The simple ethic known as tit for tat works quite well in game theory that models evolution. So it's possible to explain why we do some of the resties we do in those ways. Some people perhaps have this to a stronger degree than others and therefore are more likely to do the rescues. What's completely compatible with the Darwinian account and is not explained by the idea of a transcendental light turning on that we need to save strangers because of our belief in the sanctity of human life is precisely what I talked about before when I talked about our failure to follow the teachings of Jesus as reported in the Gospels about the rich people giving to the poor. We don't do that. We have 1 billion people living in extreme poverty in the world today, living on a dollar or so a day. We have 27,000 children under five, who died today, according to UNICEF, from avoidable poverty-related causes. That's 10 million a year, and we don't help them. Well, the Darwinian can explain why we don't help them. We've evolved these responses, this compassion, in a face-to-face society. And if we see a child there, a starving child right there, we will help. We'll take the bread off our table and give it to them, because that's how we've evolved. But if we learn through the papers that there are children in need of assistance, maybe not starving, maybe just needing better health care or safe water elsewhere in the world, most of us don't help. Christian or non-Christian, most of us don't help. And that's unfortunate, I think. I think it's contrary to the morality we should hold, but it's quite in accordance with what you would expect from a Darwinian account. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not possible for us to do more and help, to help and to act more morally than you might expect a Darwinian primate. Might expect, but not incompatibly with it. Because we can, for example, think and reason and put ourselves in the position of others. We have evolved to have a capacity to reason. That's been very useful to us in surviving in a whole lot of complex situations, and perhaps explains why we are so successful as a species in populating this planet. But the capacity to reason also makes it possible for us to think and to say, well, look, there's someone who's hungry or cold or thirsty. That must feel to them pretty much like it feels to me when I'm hungry, cold or thirsty. And if at little cost to me, little risk of my survival, I can help them, why not? Makes, you know, accords with this compassion. Something that we can, I think, reason our way to. And I don't think it needs religious inspiration. I think you can reach that through philosophical reasoning, as many philosophers have done throughout history. Not all of them Christians, and not all of them even, Dinesh, influenced by Christians, because some of them existed before Christianity. For example, the Chinese philosopher Mencius lived about 300 years before Christianity, has a document in which he recounts visiting the kingdom of King Luai and finding that people were starving, and he upbraids the king because his granaries are full and the people are starving. And he says, you say it's the season. You say it's a bad year. You know, crops were bad this year. To blame the year when your granaries are full for starving, Mencius says, is like saying it wasn't me, like the murderer saying, it wasn't me who killed him, it was the knife. So we have this compassion, we have this ethic preceding Christianity. We have it also, as I said, in non-Christian religions. We have it in Buddhism, which incidentally is an atheist religion. We have it in many other thoughts in philosophers. We have it, say, in Marcus Aurelius, the idea of universal citizenship of the world. 1 minute already. Okay, so it exists, and it's not only Christian. Now, let me just say a brief word about the claim that atheism is responsible for the mass murders of history. Certainly some mass murderers have been atheists, no question. Atheists are no better than other people. But firstly, some of the greatest mass murderers of recent times have been cheered on by the Christians. I sort of have a personal anecdote that feels this, because my parents were Jews in Vienna when Hitler marched in to occupy Austria. And they remember that the Archbishop of Vienna rang the church bells in celebration as the Nazis marched in. And when Hitler called a phony referendum on whether Austrians wished to merge with Germany, the Archbishop urged a yes vote. What also in the catalogue of murderers, along with junior league atheists like Pol Pot, what happened to Ante Pavelic, the founder of the Croatian Ustasha, who was responsible for murdering 500,000 Serbs and about 100,000 Jews and Gypsies in Croatia during the war? He doesn't seem to get a mention. Sadly, atrocities like this are not unique to atheism. They are part of what can happen to human beings in terrible circumstances.
Dinesh D'Souza.
In thinking about morality, let me begin first of all with a couple of clarifications. First of all, on this issue of caring for others and the rich and the poor, a sociologist named Arthur Brooks published a book a few months ago called Who Really Cares? It's a study of compassion, and it looks at a whole body of data on who cares for strangers, who gives time, who gives money. He divides American society into four groups. Religious conservatives, religious liberals, secular conservatives, secular liberals, self-described. And then he looks at the proportion of their income and time that they give to charity, particularly to strangers. He concludes that the group that does the most by far, many times by a factor of two over the last group, is religious conservatives. The group that does the second most is religious liberals. The group that does the third most is secular conservatives. And the group that does the least, which happens to have the most, is secular liberals. In other words, he shows, for example, that a poor religious conservative living in Oklahoma, making $30,000 a year, gives more, not only proportionately, but in real terms, than a secular liberal living in San Francisco, earning twice as much. Now, this is empirical fact. And what it seems to suggest is, instead of making broad generalizations about the rich, we've got to realize that most rich people in our society are secular. And so I agree with Peter Singer. They do too little, and they do too little in part because they are too secular. Now, let's talk for a moment about Darwin. There are two possible evolutionary bases for morality. The first, in a sense, is the idea of the shared gene. The idea here would be that a mom who jumps into a burning car to save her two children trapped inside is not just doing a wonderful, unselfish morality. She's actually trying to make sure her genes make it into the next generation. Morality is seen as a form of extended genetic selfishness. The other motive, which Peter Singer alluded to, can be called reciprocal altruism, which can be summed up, you be nice to me, and I'll be nice to you. The businessman, for example, who flatters his customer, not because he loves the guy or is being a great, wonderful human being, but because he wants the guy to come back and buy more. In other words, his morality is ultimately self-interested. And I would argue that taken together, these two Darwinian explanations can account for about 5% of what we call morality. But they don't account for most of it. For example, let's say I step into a bus. A 90-year-old woman hobbles on, and I get up and give my seat. What's my motive? Genetic selfishness? She's not nothing to me. She's not my grandmom. Is it tit for tat? I basically say, I better give her my seat because next week I want her seat. No. I'm just trying to be a nice guy. Or I give blood. Or I die for my country, or Mother Teresa on the streets of Calcutta. Even Richard Dawkins, in his book, The Selfish Gene, the most thorough discussion of this, says at the end of it very clearly, he says, pure altruism has no Darwinian foundation. In fact, he goes on to argue that we should, in a sense, be altruistic and rebel, he says, against our genes. We should, in a sense, invent unselfishness in you might say, revolt against our genetic background. So even the prime champion of evolutionary psychology in this area denies that morality can be seen as a mere spin-off of evolution. I want to now, in the very briefly contest this notion raised by Peter Singer. It's a very bizarre type of argument, by the way. He focused so much of his opening statement on the problem of evil. Not really the problem of evil, the problem of suffering. Because he said, I know, if people do bad things, that can be attributed to free will. But what about natural disasters? What about tsunamis? What about hurricanes? Essentially, his mode of argument was this. And that is essentially, can we have morality without God? The subject of our debate. There is suffering in the world. Therefore, there is no God. Therefore, we can't have morality without God. We must have secular morality. Now, what I want to ask is it true that the existence of natural evil disproves the existence of God? I want to suggest, first of all, that even if all this natural evil existed, it might call into question the nature of God, but it would in no way call into question the existence of God. It's a little bit like this. Let's say I say my dad is a wonderful, kind, compassionate guy. And then I run into a terrible problem in life. I turn to my dad, will you help me? And he won't. Do I say, I've concluded from this, Dad, that you simply don't exist? No. I would say, Dad, I thought you were a great guy, and now I've got to reassess my opinion of you. But the existence of natural evil, my point is, says absolutely nothing about the existence of God. I finally want to raise a problem in the very little time I have left, and that is that Darwinism and evolution does not just have a problem accounting for good. How can we have morality? It has an even bigger problem accounting for evil. And here's why. There is evil, of course, in the animal kingdom. A lion may chase down and ruthlessly kill an antelope. But the evil is confined. It is confined, you may say, to the domain of self-interest. The lion wants his dinner, and his brutality is aimed at getting it. But it stops there. Have you ever seen a lion that wanted to, let us say, wipe out the entire antelope population of the earth? Never. But in humans, we do. In other words, for human beings, it is not only great good, but great evil, another moral fact in the world that can't be denied. And what is the evolutionary explanation for that? I ask Peter Singer. Thank you very much.
We're at the part of the program where our speakers can ask questions of one another. Peter Singer will begin with 5 minutes for cross-examination with short and pithy responses from Dinesh D'Souza.
Thank short, you. Pithy, and devastating.
Thank you. So I'd like you to just say briefly what exactly you think it is that we can't have if there is no God, because I haven't seen you say that. I haven't seen you in terms of the three things that I set out, that there's no concept of good, or that we wouldn't know what good is, or that we wouldn't be motivated to do it. I haven't seen what you've said, maybe a bit more of the less of the last, but it seems to be rather the sort of weak view that, well, Christians are more likely to be inspired to do good. But that, even if that's true, it surely doesn't defend the idea that there can't be morality without God. Just we might, if you're right, have a bit more of it if we have people who believe in God.
Right, and I certainly don't mean to suggest that morality derives from Christian scriptures. For example, when I read the Ten Commandments, it wasn't as if I said, wow, stealing is wrong. I never knew that before. Killing is wrong. Unbelievable. I already knew that before I read those commandments. So the point here is that morality, you might say, is stamped on our human nature by God. That's why it doesn't surprise me that even the pre-Christians had, you might say, I'm just saying that even their moral sense has a transcendental foundation. So you're asking me, why do I say it is transcendental? Is that where you're getting at?
Well, no, I guess perhaps you answered the question. I want to say whether you really believe that there can't be morality without God. And if I understood you correctly, you're saying, no, I don't really believe that. So in a sense, you're conceding, at least as far as the question is concerned, maybe this is like a debating point and I don't want to just stick with that, but you are conceding that there can be morality without God. Is that correct?
No, we're talking about two different things. One is the specific historical legacy of Christianity. And I'm saying certain institutions and values that we value in the West that have to some degree now been exported worldwide. For example, the idea that slavery is inconceivable. That is the distinctive legacy of Christianity. It's not all religion, it's not God, it is a particular Christian conception of God. Then I'm making a separate point and saying, if you will, that there is embedded within us a moral law that it's embedded in you as much as me. It doesn't matter that you're an atheist and I'm a Christian. There's embedded in both of us a moral law that we acknowledge as authoritative and, in a sense, governing our actions. And I'm saying that that moral law cannot exist without a moral lawgiver. It doesn't have any, not only adequate, it doesn't have any real Darwinian explanation at all.
So there is, despite the fact that people, many people do these terrible things, they still have within them, you're saying, this moral law, which they acknowledge as authoritative, but don't follow.
Exactly. Consider Thomas Jefferson. He had 200 slaves and he never freed a single one of them. That's because he benefited from it. The selfish Darwinian part of his nature benefited from slavery. At the same time, he knew, as I would argue, virtually every southern slaveholder knew that there is something wrong and tyrannical about this, but you may say they wrestled with their consciences and won.
Right. So, in a way, we describe the same phenomenon, but slightly differently. I think this is actually really interesting, and this is exactly one of the kind of points you want to get out here. Because I would say about Jefferson that he knew that slavery was wrong because he could recognize that the slaves were people like him, who had needs like him, you know, who wanted to be with their families, but slavery sold the children off and so on. And he recognized, this is his rational capacities recognized, that he would not want that in his own case and that he couldn't really defend it. I don't see why you need to think that this capacity to recognize that has to be a kind of divine spark within us. I think I can give a purely natural account of it.
Well, you don't see, but Jefferson wouldn't agree with you, because when Jefferson, a man of the Enlightenment, a man of science, sat down to find out and to say, what is the source for rights? He was thinking of such rights as the equality of all men. Now, he could have said, the equality of rights is rooted in our reason. The equality of rights is rooted in the Enlightenment. I get it from Hume. I get it from Epictetus and so on. But when Jefferson, this man of the Enlightenment and perhaps the least orthodox of all the American founders, sat down to list the source of rights, inalienable rights, he could think of only one, and that's the Creator. So if all these other sources were available to him, why did he mention none of them?
Well, you know, I think if you want to win over the support of Americans, it was probably true in 1776 as it's true today that mentioning God is going to help you.
But if that is true, then the most famous statement of Jefferson, you might say, is a Machiavellian lie. In other words, it is ultimately, when Jefferson sat down to say, what is the basis of inalienable rights? There aren't any. And Jefferson, merely for prudential or Machiavellian reasons, said, I'm going to put God out there so the rest of the people believe it. This would strip all the philosophical content out of the Declaration of Independence, remove the uniqueness of the American idea. It seems to me that even if you're right that there is an element of flame to the crowd, it does a grave disservice to Jefferson to take perhaps his most famous formulation and simply reduce it, if you will, to Obama-like cunning.
Oh, oh. I was trying to keep politics out of this debate. But really, I mean, you know, actually, I have to say, you know, as a philosophical text, I don't think the Declaration, you know, gets us very far. But you can remove the Creator from it. You can just say, we believe these rights are self-evident. Now, then you have to examine, you know, why are some rights self-evident, why are not? And in fact, that's one of the unsatisfactory things of the rights tradition. But sorry, I'm not supposed to be making speeches, am I? Supposed to be asking you questions.
Maybe one more question.
One more question. Okay. So, well, let me ask you, since you did pick on my views as an example of some of the problems, let me, you know, I hold these views because I think there are real problems, and you seem to acknowledge that in terms of the separation that we make between humans and animals, and the fact we seem to think it's fine to confine billions of animals to, you know, appalling conditions in factory farms. I think actually that the religious traditions, and even specifically the Christian tradition, with its complete separation of humans and animals, is largely, or not largely, significantly responsible for this fact that we don't bring animals within the moral sphere. I don't see you defending that, and I do see it as a serious objection to the claim that Christianity is such an enlightened morality.
Well, I think that there is a very good reason that we make this distinction between the animals and us. And the reason can be discerned by turning on the nature channel. There you will see, for example, a gorilla move into the territory of another gorilla, bludgeon him with blows, grab the female gorilla, drag her screaming into his lair, rape her, and this is what we call the nature channel. This is perfectly acceptable, an ordinary behavior. It is, you may say, doing what comes naturally. On the other hand, if someone came into my house, knocked me down, grabbed my wife, dragged her to his apartment, and raped her, I would assume that we would see a little bit of a moral difference. And this suggests that the principles of the animal kingdom cannot be automatically exported into human life without great cost.
30 seconds.
Well, to say that what you responded to was not my position. My position is why we are prepared to inflict so much suffering on animals, not in a state of nature, but in our confined factory farms, without significant protests from Christianity.
I think that cruelty is unjustified, and I'm going to, if I may, turn it around and take my time to ask questions. Let me begin for a moment with Jefferson for a moment, because you say that we don't need a transcendental foundation for the idea of equality, which is, by the way, an idea not only at the root of Jefferson's work, but I think you will agree of your work, the reason being that utilitarianism is based on the assumption that everyone's interest counts equally. So equality is its moral foundation. Now, Jefferson says that this equality is self-evident. I maintain it is not evident at all. On every measurable characteristic, strength, speed, size, intelligence, perhaps even moral character and moral behavior, it is evident that human beings are unequal. So I ask you, in what respect is it, arguing on the basis of reason alone, self-evident that there is this equality? What is its basis? Where does it come from?
Thank you. Well, what you just said could have been a quote from actually the first chapter of Animal Liberation, where I point out exactly that human equality cannot be based on particular characteristics of human beings, whether it's rationality or intelligence or physical strength or whatever, because we vary in all those things. What I believe we mean when we talk about human equality is the idea that we should give equal consideration to our interests because we all have interests in life going well or badly. And at bottom, this is not the only thing, but at bottom that means we can suffer or we can be happy. And those are the interests that we should give equal consideration to. Of course, just as humans have different interests, some like the opera, some like heavy metal, so differences between humans and animals are also significantly different. But equal consideration of interests is, I think, a moral principle, not one dependent on the physical facts that you mentioned.
But the only principle it is dependent upon, according to you, is that we human beings are all equal in being human, and we can recognize each other as having interests. Well, let me say this. All gorillas are equal in being gorillas, and all gorillas want to survive and prosper in the world, but gorillas don't follow Jeffersonian propositions, quite apart from their inability to comprehend them. The point I'm trying to get at is they don't act as if they say, oh, I'm a gorilla. All of us gorillas want to get along, so let me recognize that my welfare is really tied in with the welfare of all the other gorillas here, so let me stand in line before I mount the female gorilla, even though I'm the strongest in the pack. We don't see that kind of behavior at all. In fact, it seems to me that the self-evident equality that you're pointing to is a thoroughly Western idea that is emphatically rejected in other cultures. In fact, it's even controversial in Western culture. I think I was watching the other day, I think it might have been George Carlin, who was saying that a tragedy is when I cut my little finger, a comedy is when you fall into an open manhole and die. The point being that we take great pleasure sometimes in seeing other people suffer. There's absolutely no reason that if we don't care about these people in the first place, that their suffering should matter to us at all. And so when you say you're crossing this long land bridge We can recognize other people as fellow human beings, and therefore we should stay up at night, in fact sacrifice our standard of living, because there are guys in Rwanda who don't have enough to eat. I am saying that there is a hidden presumption of moral equality in there that does not seem to make sense if you remove the missing term, namely created equal in the eyes of God. Ultimately, it's that spiritual equality that makes the whole thing work. What is?
Well, it's not, firstly, it's not that we recognize each other as equally human, it's that we recognize as equally capable of suffering. And that's why the boundary of our species shouldn't be the boundary of moral concern. Now, in your remarks about the fact that gorillas don't follow these principles, you're confusing the issue of who is a moral agent and who is a subject of moral concern, you might say a moral patient. Of course, you have to have a certain level of cognitive capacity or rationality to be a moral agent. And that's why a human child of a year old is not a moral agent, and a human with severe brain damage may not be a moral agent either. But they are still moral patients. That is, it still matters how we treat them because they're capable of suffering. It's in the capacity to suffer that I believe that we're equal. And if you ask what's the moral foundation of that, it's what I said before in talking about Jefferson. It's our capacity to put ourselves in the position of those beings and to say, how would I like it if I were like them? And answer, I wouldn't. And that, incidentally, is not specifically a Christian. You've recognized the golden rule, of course, but that's not specifically a Christian nor even a Judeo-Christian precept, but one that you find in many other cultures. In fact, I would say in every culture with a developed ethical tradition.
But right away you seem to concede that this moral agency is a unique property of human beings. Even our closest evolutionary cousins don't have it. That's point number one. And the second point is, I can understand if I say he's suffering in the way that I would suffer if I was in his position or her position. But then a light goes on my head and says, but I'm not in his position. And so where do I go from I recognize that he's suffering to this suffering is morally significant to me, and I now have, you may say, ethical duties to help this guy. We're moving outside the realm of feeling. He suffers, I suffer, I feel bad. To now something more in the nature of law. And law is moving outside, you may say, the scientific domain, a description of matter, to the ethical domain, thou shalt not. It seems to me you're making no effort except vaguely invoking reason to show how this chasm between us as creatures in the world, acting, you may say, on the force of necessity. A stone has no choice but to roll down a hill. A cheetah has no choice but to chase after the deer. But you or I have a choice of whether or not to help the suffering guy. That alone is a huge difference.
You have no choice but to give one sentence in response.
Okay, it's a profound problem, I agree. But I think when we live socially, we construct moral codes on the basis of our capacity to reason about what we think ought to be done when we consider the interests of all those we can imagine ourselves in the position of.
30 seconds.
Well, it seems to me that while you say we construct moral codes on the basis of reason, I'm not aware of a single such code in existence that anyone actually follows. The truth of it is that the moral codes of every human society are transmitted by religion. If you ask someone why you behave the way you do, he might say, I'm a Hindu, or I'm a Muslim, or I'm a Christian. I've never heard a single person, not even a Princetonian, say, I act the way I do because I am a Hegelian. Or I act the way I do because I am a utilitarian. The truth of it is, philosophers may dispute about these moral codes and draw up their own lists, but they have absolutely no significance on the way people actually live. And so one interesting question to ask is, if it is the case that morality is this project of reason, whose morality, which philosopher's morality, becomes the mechanism by which we instruct our young, given the fact that every two philosophers in the room have an utterly different basis for morality, and given the practical reality that religion has in fact been the way in which morality has instructed young people for millennia, what makes us think that we can do it better any other way?
Okay, I think we've seen that at least two philosophers have different bases for morality, and now is your opportunity for questions. some of which are directed to an individual speaker, some of which are to both of them. And I might ask our speakers to keep their responses short, pithy, and biting. Is that what you said? No.
Devastating. Devastating.
Devastating. So the first is for Dinesh D'Souza. In your book, What's So Great About Christianity, you defend the idea of a universal moral law, which is known by everyone. You also claim that this view meshes very well with the Christian conception of God as the author of moral laws. But the idea of a fixed hierarchical moral order has often been used to justify the subordination of women, slaves, and colonized peoples. How does your understanding of a universal moral law fit with the idea of ethical breakthroughs, which were not obvious to everyone before they were made?
I think that the abuses of religion can in almost every case be understood as a sort of taking over of the pre-existing abuses of the society in which the religion found itself. For example, Christianity inherited the Roman Empire. It was the Roman legions that carried Christianity throughout Europe. In a system of government defined by monarchy and aristocracy, it's not surprising that institutionally Christianity became, you might say, a system wedded to the oppressive alliance of throne and altar. When we think of the Enlightenment, many people think it was a rebellion against Christianity, but no, I think it was a rebellion against a correct assessment that Christianity had become too entangled with the interests of royalty and the interests of aristocracy. When I'm speaking of the moral law, by the way, again, I'm not speaking of a moral law excavated from the Old or even the New Testament. I'm simply saying something like this, and that is, there is embedded in each one of us morality. Without it, we wouldn't be human. In fact, people who don't have morality, we call sociopaths, and we put them in straitjackets. So morality is a fact as real as any in the world. It demands a careful explanation. And the question is, does the transcendental explanation make more sense? Or does it make more sense to say morality is somehow a project of enforced reason?
This is for Peter Singer. Do you think Mr. D'Souza, in his belief in God, is rational but mistaken? Or do you think he is irrational?
I think he's irrational.
So, is it rational, I might add as a proviso, to believe in morality with God, or is that fundamentally irrational?
Well, as I said at the beginning, there are many concepts of God. And in fact, one of the interesting things that emerged from the debate, if you remember, Dinesh said something about the problem of evil might change your concept of God, as it might change your concept of who your dad is if he doesn't help you when you really need him. So that's really interesting, because that's a significant departure, I would say, from the standard concept of God as omnipotent, omniscient, and omnibenevolent, which is so central to the Judeo-Christian tradition. If Dinesh is really admitting that he doesn't believe in that kind of God, then I would need to know more about what kind of God he believes in before I could judge whether he actually is being irrational in that. So let me put it this way. It's conceivable to me. I don't really think it's very plausible. I don't think, you know, we need this hypothesis at all, as Voltaire said. But it's conceivable that there are some kinds of gods that it might not be irrational to believe in. And then, of course, you could believe in a morality that was related in some way to that God, though you would need to explain what exactly the link was and why that was necessary.
If one is going to insist that belief in God...
Does he get a chance to respond to my answers to the questions? This is new.
I can vindicate my rationality.
This might allow you to do that.
Okay.
I'll ask another question. This is along the same lines. If someone does not have to be a theist to behave morally, if that's what your claim was, do you think any non-theistic account of morality is incomplete or contradictory? That is the practice of the atheist better than the theory or you have to be moved by a conception of God's will or God's authority in order for a moral act to be fully moral? I think this is the question. Is our pagan virtues just splendid vices without God?
Sure. Well, let me say, first of all, that most human beings through most of history have believed in God. You may say God has survived in an unbelievable way in evolutionary terms. And if someone is going to decide or declare in advance that, let's say, 95% of the world's people are irrational, this not only smacks of a kind of very annoying elitism, but it doesn't even begin to answer the question, what is the survival value of such irrationality? Think about it. It doesn't make sense for us as evolutionary animals to believe things that are manifestly untrue. Consider the case of a rabbit who is being pursued by a lion. And the rabbit's question is, should I run or should I not run? And there are two rabbits, the religious rabbit and the atheist rabbit. The atheist rabbit says, I have one life to live, run. The religious rabbit says, no, there's a better life waiting for me elsewhere. I don't need to run. Which rabbit would survive? Point I'm getting at here is, it is irrational to dismiss religion in so cavalier a way. At the very least, if most people are irrational, you've now got to give an account for why Peter Singer's eminently rational project can work with irrational human beings. Now, with regard to non-theistic morality, here's the point I'm getting at. And that is, I'm accusing, in a way, the atheist of profound ingratitude. I'm saying to the atheist what the greatest living philosopher, arguably, and an atheist, Habermas, Jürgen Habermas, said, that is that the core principles of our civilization, liberty, equality, human dignity, and the idea of justice, he says, are rooted in the Hebrew tradition of the prophets and the Christian tradition of Christ. Now, what he's saying is, even secular people ought to recognize this. It doesn't take a great deal of historical investigation to see that our civilization is built on Athens and Jerusalem. That is an historical fact. Our institutions and values come out of that. So the atheist is standing on a religious mountain that he or she ungratefully refuses to acknowledge. He's pretending or she's pretending, I'm developing a purely secular ethic, although buried in that secular ethic are assumptions of compassion, of concern, of universal human brotherhood, of equality that have all been smuggled in and imported from Christianity.
For Peter Singer, if there is no creator to decide what is right, how are your views any more legitimate than anyone else's? Aren't yours just a set of preferences? What foundations do you ground human values on?
How are my views more legitimate than anyone else's? In one sense, the answer to that is simply, they're not. That is, they have no authority. I'm not asking you to believe what I say because I'm a professor at Princeton or anything of the sort. On the other hand, I'm asking you to listen to what I'm saying and to the reasons why I'm saying it. And if my views are more legitimate than someone else's, it's because you think I've given better reasons for what I've said than that someone else, whoever that might be, would be. So that's your decision. That's, you know, up to you and others who discuss the issue to see how the arguments come out. And that's what legitimacy in this area of philosophy consists in.
I'm going to go with the individual questions and then we'll end with the questions for both. I think we'll have time to get to all of them if our speakers continue in their short, pithy ways. Dinesh D'Souza, if the inner sense that you describe is the clue that God exists and therefore the guide to us to find morality, does what our inner sense say supersede the dictates of God? Could there be a conflict between these two moral guides, the inner sense and God?
Two things about that. First of all, I think that is a restatement of the conundrum raised by Plato that Peter Singer alluded to. First of all, let me say that I think that the reason I identify this inner sense as transcendental is that morality in general can be almost defined as that which militates against self-interest. If Darwinism can be understood as self-interest writ large, then morality can be understood as that which tells you to act against doing something that you otherwise would want to do. I want to steal. I want to have sex with every beautiful woman in the world. I want to spread my genes. Now, true, there is a sense in which, as a Machiavellian, I might say, I want to make sure I don't get caught. But short of that, that's my Darwinian goal. The voice that tells me not to do this is thwarting me at every stage. Every time I try to do something for my own benefit, it whispers no. So it is the fact that our, this inner sense operates against Darwinian self-interest that is a clue to its nature. Second point is the question of, is it from God or is it not from God, and is justice identical with God? I think we're making here what philosophers sometimes call a category mistake, and I'll explain what I mean by reference to Plato himself. Plato's talking about justice. And he says, rather surprisingly, that the highest form of justice is discretion. Now, for us, that's surprising because we always learn that the best form of justice is law. But Plato says, no. If you have, you might say, full information, if you are a philosopher king, if you are a god, then you will apply justice tailored to the individual situation. For example, if I have three children, I don't make laws. I look at their individual needs and I pattern my treatment of each one according to their own talents and needs. It is only in liberal society, when you descend from the God's eye point of view to the human point of view, where we distrust human authority, that we say, look, we don't want to have discretion, we would rather live with law. In other words, when I'm speeding on the highway, I don't want to say, I let the cop kind of decide if I'm going too fast. There are some people who go safely at 70. There are other people who drive unsafely at 30. We're just going to let discretion be the order of the day. No, because we don't trust the cop. So we say, we'll all drive at 65 miles an hour or less, because liberalism is for human beings. Another way to put it is law is for fallible human beings. Law does not apply to God, because God is in that Platonic position of discretion. So the problem raised by Plato is a legitimate one as applied to all human beings. It is a meaningless one as applied to God.
Peter Singer, how do you explain humanity's ability to appreciate beauty, this hall, to love, to cry? Animals, non-human animals, do not have this.
Oh, I think that's clearly false in terms of love, for example. Obviously, you know, beings with more sophisticated abilities can love in different ways, but it seems quite evident if you observe behavior of non-human animals, particularly, you know, I'm thinking about mammals here, that there is love. One of the things that I object to about farming, for example, is that to produce the milk you drink, you have to repeatedly make cows pregnant and remove their calves so that you can get the milk. And clearly, every farmer who does that will tell you that the cow misses her calf and vice versa, that she looks around where the calf was. I've read anecdotes from farmers that months after the calf was taken from the cow, every time the cow passed that point, she looked around and bellowed for the calf. There is certainly mother-child love in animals. There is, I would say, there's clearly sexual love, sexual bonding in animals. So, you know, the human phenomenon is more complicated. It involves higher mental capacities, no doubt about it, but it is fundamentally the same capacity. And I think, you know, these other capacities that you asked about also have those kinds of accounts. Now, even in terms of beauty, there's an account in a book that I co-edited called The Great Ape Project by an observer of chimpanzees in Africa, how a chimpanzee would climb the ridge just before sunset and settle down on the ridge to watch the sun setting over Lake Tanganyika, clearly appreciating the spectacle, as indeed the human observer was. You know, this goes right back to Darwin's little book on the expression of the emotions in man and animals. What we have is continuous with the emotions that animals feel.
Mr. D'Souza, why do you seem to consider only the Christian God moral, What about other monotheistic faiths? And I might sneak in one because there's more for you. What do you think about Kant's argument that humans can have an understanding of goodness, perfection, and therefore a moral sense independent of God?
Well, first of all, that is not exactly Kant's position. Kant's position is that this morality derived from reason is nevertheless postulated on an assumption of God. But on other religions, I think that, look, all religions in the world are based on some idea of cosmic justice. Right away, you see a problem with purely secular morality. The problem with secular morality is that we live in a world where many times bad people prosper and good people come to grief. So any instruction we give people to be good must be sorely qualified by the recognition that many times it is the terrible guy who ends up on top, many times it's the good guy who comes to grief. Now, all the great religions of the world, in a sense, are based on the idea that while that may be the story of life, it's not the full story. That there's ultimately, you may say, cosmic accountability. So if you consider Hinduism, the idea may be that you are a perfect jerk in this life, so we're going to be seeing you as a cockroach in the next life. Cosmic justice. While the different religions of the world might differ in theology, they very often agree on morality. The theologian Hans Kung, a couple of years ago, assembled what he called the World Parliament of Religions. The Buddhists, the Taoists, the Muslims, the Hindus, all in the same room. And they sat down to say, what common things can we agree upon? And they drew up a charter, and it's a rather long one. The whole book is based on it. And it turns out that while the religions of the world disagree about the nature of God, the Trinity, flood stories, creation myths, and so on, when it comes down to how people should live in the world, there are enormous degrees of similarity, suggesting that this idea that there is a universal moral law actually does have a good deal of empirical confirmation.
Peter Singer, how can you assume evil exists if God doesn't? What is it about suffering that is inherently wrong if God does not exist?
Well, the term evil is a tricky one because sometimes it's used in a way that assumes a theological background. In other words, you know, evil is related to the fall or the devil or something like that. Obviously, I'm not using it in that sense. I regard the things that I described, the things that occurred at 9/11 or in the Congo or Darfur or in Mumbai, as very bad things. I don't need to use the word evil. And they're bad because if we put ourselves in the position of those humans who suffer those things, or perhaps were the loved ones of those who died in those events, we would not want that to happen. And that obviously is a grotesque understatement. That would be a horrible thing to happen to us. So when these things happen to beings who suffer in that way, that's what's bad about it. We don't want it for ourselves. We wouldn't want it in their position. That's what I mean by saying that, at least other things being equal. Sometimes good may come out of suffering, of course, but other things being equal, suffering is something that's bad.
Dinesh D'Souza, if God exists, why be moral? Because of punishment? This seems like a wrong kind of reason. And I'm going to add one. Why would God have created us if he knows that we can't help but fail to reach the moral standards he has created for us, the only beings capable of understanding them?
I think that these problems of a standard too high for us to live by do count to some degree against Judaism and Islam, because Judaism and Islam posit, as all religions do, a chasm between man and God, and then erect a set of codes or rules to, you might say, build a ladder from the human to the divine. And nevertheless, while acknowledging that this ladder is never going to be tall enough, you're never going to be able to cross this chasm, Christianity recognizes this and proclaims in advance that this human project to build a ladder between the human and the divine cannot work. If the chasm is going to be crossed, maybe it can't be crossed, but if it's going to be crossed, the only way for that to happen is for God to act. God has in some mysterious way got to descend to the human level and close the gap. And so Christian theology, I think, is unique among all religions in declaring that human beings will fall short, but that doesn't really matter, because even if they tried, they could not possibly succeed. Ultimately, God has to do all the work. I see Christ as a divine emissary, if you will, into the world to close this gap. Christ pays, if you will, the price. And so the human job becomes unbelievably simple. It becomes simply a matter of signing off or saying yes to a sacrifice already done. And even the person who has done terrible things can, in a sense, by affirming this Christian sacrifice, gain access to salvation. What could be, in a sense, more gentle and mild? And how strong is the selfishness of human nature that even this gentle requirement, which is essentially accepting a gift freely given, is nevertheless so fiercely resisted?
Two more questions for Peter Singer and Dinesh D'Souza. Some Christians hold that the suffering not caused by free will is the result of a fallen creation that occurred at the time of the fall of man. What are your views on this?
Do you want me to go first?
Peter Singer, you can go first.
I think it's an appalling view, I have to say. I mean, that beings now, including small children, including animals, all of us, whether innocent or guilty, are suffering because of something that is supposed to have happened 4004 BC, was it? I don't know that I have my dates right, but it was a long time ago, and none of us are responsible for it. None of us did it. So what kind of a being would have allowed this to happen and would punish us, make us suffer because of that? It's a horrendous story if you really think about it and take it seriously. And it says something about a religious sense of morality that many religious people have actually believed this story.
The existence of natural evil, I think, cannot be reasonably attributed to the fall, certainly not the fall of man, for the very simple reason that these disasters occurred long before man set foot on the planet. There were animals on Earth before there was man, there were plants on Earth before there was man, and suffering preceded man. The question we have to then ask is, why is there suffering at all, and why would a God have created it? I think the answer to this question, at least, and it's a very old question, my own answer I'm going to give very partially, and then if I need to explain a little bit more in my closing statement, is the decision of God to create a lawful universe is the core of the answer to this problem. In other words, God had a choice. He could have created what could be called a lawful universe, the one we have, or he could have created what can be called a whimsical universe. A whimsical universe would be a universe where God arbitrarily intervened every time he saw a problem. A four-year-old gets cancer, God moves in, zaps the cancer, and the kid gets well. A tsunami is heading towards Sri Lanka, God dives into the picture, diverts the tsunami, and all is well. It's very easy for us to play God and say, gee, I wish God had done it that way. But we never think through the implications of that. Let's imagine that God did do it that way. For starters, we would not have a lawful universe. And if we didn't have a lawful universe, at the very least, we would not have anything that we call science. What we call science is based on the idea that nature is regular, and we can determine the regularities of its laws. As a consequence of us being able to do that, the human lifespan has been extended from some 35 years to now something approaching 80 years. Because of science, we have technology, inventions, men on the moon, iPhones. Pretty much all the relief of suffering and the amenities of modern life are the consequence of living in a lawful universe. And so I ask you, do you actually want to live in a whimsical universe? Or do you prefer to live in a universe where we, as autonomous creatures of God, participate in his own creative, inventive genius, so that it's not only God who creates the world, but we participate in making the world better? it's possible that we would have been better off the other way, but it's by no means obvious.
We have 1 minute left for the questions, and I'm going to end with this one. So you have 30 seconds. For Peter Singer, what would it take for you to believe in God? For Dinesh D'Souza,
I want the heavens to open and a voice to come down and say, Peter Singer, you got it wrong, I'm here. And I want that to be a repeatable and observable phenomenon, not a temporary hysteria.
We'll walk outside. For Dinesh D'Souza, what would it take for you not to believe in God?
Well, first of all, the idea, I think Peter Singer's answer gives, in some ways, almost a parody of the scientific method. Because think about it, even if every day there was a voice from the heavens that said, I, God, made the world, and you, Peter Singer, in it. Even if every planet had stamped on it, Yahweh made this. We still wouldn't know who put the stamp there. We still wouldn't know where the voice is coming from. The fact that something is repeated again and again and again has said absolutely nothing about what its source is. So I think this is a perfect example of how we trust in science to deliver answers that lie outside the orbit of science. We pretend that if something occurs repeatedly, it's natural. If something occurs once, it's a miracle. Whereas if you really think about it, both are equally strange. Now, what would it take for me not to believe in God? Look, if someone could make for me convincing arguments for why there not only is no God, but really couldn't be a God. Or to put it somewhat differently, if all important human questions could be given a purely natural answer, I would stop believing in God. I would argue that the biggest human questions, why do we have a universe? We have a universe. There was once no universe. Our universe had a beginning. That's a scientific fact. Where did we get a universe? Number two, we once had non-life. We now have life. How did we get life? Third, we have a continuum, a Darwinian continuum with the animals, which I accept. On the other hand, there are specific features of our humanity that not only defy but confound Darwinian explanation. Our consciousness. What is the evolutionary value? What's the survival value of that? Our morality, which ultimately speaks in the very peculiar, unscientific language, not of this is the way it is, but this is the way it ought to be. These questions, if you think about it, modern science has not progressed very much since the time of the Babylonians in answering these large questions. And I think this is where, ultimately, metaphysics comes in. The transcendental explanation has answers, and you may say the Darwinian explanation is left fumbling. So if that could be changed, I would then have to reconsider my belief in God.
We've reached the point of closing statements. Dinesh D'Souza will have 3 minutes, then Peter Singer, 3 minutes.
I want to say how much I've enjoyed this discussion. I've been debating a number of leading atheists. Very often it's a gladiatorial contest, as this has been to some degree. But I think in some ways we have tried very hard to also transcend that and keep it substantive as well as entertaining. I think the revealing moment in the debate came when Peter Singer said that he couldn't really even use the term evil. He said he could say something was bad if, let's say, someone had a toothache or if maybe 10 people were killed, that would be very bad. And maybe if 6 million Jews were killed, that would be very, very, very bad. But ultimately, he couldn't bring himself to say, this is wrong. Or perhaps he would say, this is wrong for me. Or I wouldn't like to be in that position. But I think if we think about it, this does not do justice to what is in front of us. In a sense, what we're seeing is not something that, gee, I'm kind of glad it wasn't me, because that cuts both ways. If there's a terrible, there were recently these terrorist bombings in India. One side of me said, oh, wow, those are Indians. They're just like me being blown up. The other side of me said, I'm glad I'm not in India. So the point I'm trying to make is that this mere identification doesn't by itself produce adequate empathy, and it certainly doesn't produce obligation, because we are ultimately still left with, why should we care about any of this? If ultimately our job in the world is to survive and to look out for our long-term interest, tit for tat only applies when there is a tat. If I'm doing business with somebody, if I can rape a girl and she'll never have a chance to bring charges against me, I'm doing something, there's no tit for tat. I'll never have to pay for this. I'll never have to account for it. So where does the voice come in that tells me that if I do this, even if I never get caught, it's a terribly wrong thing to do? It is, in fact, an evil thing to do. In a sense, we heard a lot about the rights. Oh, I have a minute left. Natural evil, which has been in some ways Peter Singer's strong point here. Why do we have natural evil? Why do we have tsunamis? Why do we have earthquakes? I would recommend to you this book. It's called Rare Earth, written by a prominent geologist, Peter Ward, and a prominent astronomer, Darnell Brownlee. And they actually give you the answer. Why do we have earthquakes? Why do we have tsunamis? Simple answer, because we live in a universe that has plate tectonics. They point out, by the way, that this quality of our universe, plate tectonics, which is movements under, if you will, the ocean floor and the Earth's floor, is, as far as we know, astronomically unique. No other planet has plate tectonics. And why do we need plate tectonics? Is it to stabilize the climate? Yes. Is it ultimately to keep the land separate from the water? Yes. But the ultimate reason is actually the most interesting of all. If we didn't have plate tectonics, we wouldn't have life. We wouldn't have human life. No, we wouldn't have human life or animal life or any kind of complex life whatsoever. In other words, our universe operates according to what can be called a fine-tuned or anthropic principle. Many of the properties of the universe must be what they are, because if they weren't, we wouldn't be here. This comes back to the question I raised earlier. Why did God create a lawful universe? Why did He create in it autonomous human beings like you and me, who can not only do good, but also do evil? I think God did that not only because this is a wonderful, powerful, grand, awesome world that we live in, but I think also because God, in some senses, wanted to create human beings who share His autonomy, who share His free will. And with the free will to do good comes also, alas, the free will to do evil. Before we condemn that system, we have to ask, have we seriously thought about a different kind of universe that we could devise better? Thank you very much.
Professor Singer.
Thank you. In closing remarks and just before, Dinesh introduced some new claims about why he believes in God, including the claim that he said it's a scientific fact that the universe had a beginning. I have to correct that. It is not a scientific fact. If some of you here perhaps may have been fortunate to be students of Professor Lyman Page, Professor of Physics at this university, who more than anyone else has advanced our observation of the Big Bang some 13 billion years ago. He could put a more precise date on it than that. But, and presumably this is what Dinesh means when he said the universe had a beginning, but if you ask him, does science know that that was the beginning of the universe? He says no. Science can't tell you that. Science can't tell you what happened before the Big Bang. That's not observable. So it's quite possible that the universe has existed forever as an infinity of oscillations between contraction, Big Bang, and expansion. That's perfectly possible. Dinesh also put it wrong in his closing statement when he said that I can't bring myself to use the term evil. Actually, I use the term problem of evil a lot. I just wanted to make it clear that I'm not using this in the theological sense, obviously. And then he said, all I can bring myself to say is that something is bad. And he said, I can't even bring myself to say that it's wrong, but then he admitted I could, but I mean wrong for me. That's all not true. I'm not a subjectivist about morality. Because we have the capacity to reason, because we can all put ourselves in the position of others, because we can get together as social communicating beings and discuss what is best for all of us if we do put ourselves in the position of everyone, we can talk about what is wrong simpliciter, meaning wrong for all of the beings, all of the sentient beings who will be affected by it. You don't have to be a subjectivist to be an atheist about morality. Now, Dinesh, again, said that the problem of evil may force us to change our conception of God. He hasn't still explained in what way it does. What he said about God wanting to create a lawful universe is, I think, quite puzzling, because you would have to imagine that this is a great enough good in some way to outweigh all the suffering that is caused through God's non-intervention. It's one of these views, the theological view, where God kind of creates the world, sets it running like a clock, and then walks away from it in some sense, leaves it alone. That's a different view, certainly, from the standard Christian view. And I can't see what the good would be. I mean, Dinesh said, well, thanks to science, which the law-like nature of the universe made possible, we've extended our life expectancy from 35 years to 80. Wow. Think what God could have done if he'd wanted us to live longer. It doesn't seem enough compensation for me, and we still don't have an explanation. Okay, just to wind up, let me say, I acknowledge what Dinesh said, by the way. I think this has been a good debate, because we have got down to some really fundamental issues about philosophy and about the nature of morality and the universe. That's exactly what we should be doing in a great university. So, again, I want to thank the people who've made this possible. But I think, having done that, we can see that the conclusion that morality is the product of beings who came to exist in roughly a Darwinian manner, but developed rational capacities and empathy with others, is a perfectly plausible explanation of the existence of morality, and I would say a much more parsimonious one than one which requires you to postulate the addition of a divine creator who implanted in us a kind of transcendent spark of moral law, which I think we can explain without that kind of being. Thank you.
Now I want to ask you to thank our speakers, but also thank yourselves for your good questions and your civility. And please join me in thanking both of our speakers.